Welcome to the Divergent Files podcast. What if the most dangerous mind control program in history is the one the government says never existed? And still, versions of the same story keep surfacing. People describing similar symbols, similar language, similar strange internal structures, even when they were never supposed to know each other. Now, hold on for a second, because that doesn't prove anything by itself, but it does raise a question. Because even if some of this came from suggestion, rumor, or people trying to explain something they didn't fully understand, why does it keep showing up in roughly the same shape? So let me show you what that can look like. Not a confirmed case, a composite. The kind of story people keep describing around the edges of this subject. A girl wakes up in a motel room. She doesn't know how she got there. There's a hospital band around her wrist, a butterfly tattoo on her shoulder, and this vague flicker in the back of her mind. Bright lights, a man's voice, and the smell of antiseptic. There's blood on the sink, a note on the floor, one word written in blue ink, remember. She doesn't know who wrote it, but something in her gut says this feeling isn't new. Not the room itself, but the fear and the confusion. That blank space where memory should be. And she's not the only one. That's where this story gets pretty difficult, because this isn't really about conspiracy in the way people think. It's about trauma, memory, about control, and what happens when people describe the same kind of psychological damage, but the paper trail never quite catches up. So in this episode, we're going to trace where the idea of Project Monarch comes from. Not by chasing rumor, but instead by following the edge where documented CIA research, trauma science, recurring testimony, and survivor accounts start brushing up against each other. And not to force an answer, and definitely not to pretend certainty where there isn't any. Just to ask the question most people would rather avoid. Because if a program like Monarch never existed, why do so many unrelated people keep describing something that sounds like it did? And if memory can fracture under extreme conditions, what happens to identity when that happens? What happens to your choice? And who gets to decide which part of you is still even you? This is Divergent Files. This episode includes descriptions of trauma, abuse, and psychological manipulation. Please take care while watching. If you're a survivor or this material hits too close to home, support resources are listed at the end of the episode. Monarch doesn't show up in any CIA budget. There's no official code name for it in the declassified record. There's no file, no document with that title stamped across the top. So if you go looking for Project Monarch in the historical record, you won't find it. At least, not the way you'd expect. And normally, that would be the end of the story. No file, no program. Except, the strange part is that the patterns people associate with Monarch keep surfacing anyway. They show up in survivor testimony, in court proceedings, and in psychiatric material that was never meant for public debate in the first place. And that creates a weird problem. Because even if a story starts as rumor, suggestion, or people trying to explain something they don't fully understand, you'd still expect it to fade if there was nothing underneath it. Instead, this story keeps resurfacing. So where does the idea even come from? Well, most researchers trace it back to MKUltra. That part is not controversial. MKUltra was the CIA's Cold War mind control research program. Congress confirmed it in 1975 during the Church Committee investigation. It involved hundreds of experiments using drugs, hypnosis, electroshock, and sensory deprivation, often on people who had no idea they were part of an experiment. The stated goal, in the CIA's own language, was to explore ways to break down human consciousness and then rebuild it. Now, here's something most people don't realize. MKUltra wasn't one project. It was 149 sub-projects scattered across universities, hospitals, and research institutions. And the majority of those records? Gone. They were destroyed in 1973 on orders from CIA Director Richard Helms, just before Congress could subpoena them. And that's not speculation, that's in the record. Which means historians investigating MKUltra are working with a partial archive. Large parts of the program simply disappeared. Now, here's where Monarch enters the picture. Or, more accurately, where it doesn't. Because the name Project Monarch does not appear in those surviving documents. Not once. Not even a redacted fragment. So if Monarch existed as a formal CIA program, there's no paperwork proving it. But yet, years later, people started describing something that sounded familiar in all the wrong ways. Not the LSD experiments or hypnosis trials most people associate with early MKUltra. Something much darker. Accounts involving extreme trauma, deliberate psychological fracture, and memory broken into compartments. So, now hold on. That doesn't automatically mean anyone was programming minds, because there's an important complication here. During the 1980s and early 1990s, therapy techniques like hypnosis and memory regression were widely used, sometimes carefully, sometimes less carefully than they should have been. And those methods were later criticized for accidentally shaping patient memories. So yes, suggestion could explain some of these accounts. That possibility has to stay on the table. But even accounting for that, something about the overlap made clinicians quite uneasy. Because patients who had never met each other weren't just describing trauma, they were describing structure. The kind of thing that made people stop and pay attention. Compartmentalized identities, trigger phrases, even roles assigned to different parts of the mind. In 1992, psychiatrist Dr. D. Corydon Hammond spoke about this pattern at a conference for mental health professionals. He wasn't claiming the CIA confirmed anything. What he was describing was something he and other clinicians said they were seeing repeatedly in patients. Trauma used to fracture identity, separate internal roles, and recurring symbolic frameworks that kept showing up even when the patients had no clear connection to one another. Hammond referred to this structure as green balm. But many of the patients he was treating used a different word, monarch. Not because they saw it in a document, because it was the name they used for the same internal structure they were trying to describe. The government never acknowledged it. No agency claimed responsibility for it. And mainstream media largely treated the whole subject like just fantasy. But the accounts didn't stop, and the question didn't either. Because even with all the uncertainty, the same basic shape kept resurfacing. And if there was never a paper trail, you're left with one uncomfortable possibility. Either the name came later, or the paperwork was never the thing that mattered most. Here's where the story gets more complicated. The techniques people later associated with Monarch were already being studied decades earlier. On paper, inside programs we do know existed. Earlier CIA research projects like Bluebird, Artichoke, and eventually MKUltra explored ways to disrupt memory, influence behavior, and manipulate perception. That much is documented. But by the 1980s, some survivor testimony began describing something that sounded different from those earlier experiments. And not just drugs, not just the interrogation techniques. Something much closer to trauma being used deliberately to fracture identity. Around the same time, older records resurfaced that made some clinicians uneasy. One of the most disturbing came from Dr. Donald Ewan Cameron. Cameron was an MKUltra contractor working at McGill University in Canada. His experiments, known as psychic driving, were built around a brutal idea. Overwhelm the mind hard enough to break memory down, then try to rebuild the personality from whatever was left. patients were subjected to prolonged isolation, repeated electroshock, and recorded audio messages played thousands of times. Many never fully recovered. And that's not allegation, that's documented. Then there was St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. Publicly, it was a psychiatric institution. But records later showed it was also involved in behavioral research connected to military and intelligence interests. Researchers there examined things like dissociation, hypnosis, and trauma response, the same broad categories that show up again and again in later monarch-related claims. Now, let's pause there for just a second, because none of this proves a program called Monarch existed, but it does establish something important. The methods people later associated with Monarch weren't imaginary. They were studied, funded, and documented under other names. What never appears anywhere in the historical record is the label itself. Monarch shows up much later, mostly in survivor testimony. Beginning in the 1980s, patients in therapy started using that same word to describe what they believed had happened to them. Monarch. Now, that shared language could have spread through books, therapists, or even cultural exposure. That possibility has to stay on the table. But even allowing for that, the descriptions themselves kept circling the same kinds of structures. Compartmentalized identities, internal hierarchies, and trauma used as a tool instead of just an outcome. Which narrows the real question. If the government never used the name, and no document ever confirmed the program, then where exactly did that framework come from? Because whatever the answer is, the label may be late, but the methods, well, they clearly aren't. Now imagine this, a child is restrained. There are wires on their head and a light keeps flashing on and off while someone leans in close and repeats the same phrase over and over. Years later, the child remembers the light, but not the voice, not the words. And that split matters, because this is where the Monarch story actually lives, not in some file sitting in an archive, and not in a code name buried in a memo. It lives in the break, that moment when the brain gets pushed past what it can handle, and something inside the mind stops processing experience the normal way. Psychologists have a name for that, dissociation. And this part isn't controversial. Dissociation is a documented trauma response. When the brain faces something it cannot process, it can wall that experience off so the person can survive it. But sometimes, the split doesn't close again. In severe cases, the structure of the mind itself starts shifting. Memories stop connecting the way they used to. Emotions get locked behind different walls, and people begin describing separate internal roles, almost like different parts of the same mind handling different jobs. Psychiatry eventually gave that pattern a name, dissociative identity disorder. The terminology has changed over the years, but versions of the diagnosis appear in the psychiatric record as early as 1980. So the condition itself isn't the mystery. The uncomfortable question is something much else. Did anyone ever try to induce that state on purpose? Because if the answer to that question is yes, then we're not talking about a mental illness. We're talking about a technique. And that's the part that made me go back to the original MKUltra records once again. And this is where things start getting uncomfortable. During the 1950s and 1960s, CIA-funded researchers weren't just observing dissociation. They were studying ways to produce disorientation, depersonalization, and breaks in memory under controlled conditions. MKUltra documents describe experiments involving electroshock, sensory deprivation, isolation, and patterned audiovisual stimuli. One file refers to something called psychological driving. Another outlines methods for disrupting identity continuity. The language is very real, and these experiments weren't theoretical. They happened in hospitals, prisons, and psychiatric institutions, often on people who never consented. In documented cases, especially among already institutionalized or otherwise vulnerable populations, the line between patient and subject was often disturbingly thin. And then there's Dr. Ewan Cameron. Cameron wasn't speculating about memory breakdown. Under MKUltra, Subproject 68, he was given broad authority to experiment with breaking down and rebuilding the human personality. His patients, many admitted for relatively mild psychiatric issues, were subjected to repeated electroshock, heavy sedation, prolonged isolation, and recorded audio messages played on loop for days at a time. Thousands of repetitions. Some left unable to recognize their own family members. And some never recovered. And that's not rumor, that's documented history. At the same time, military researchers were asking a slightly different question, not about trauma itself, but about stimulus. Could light, sound, and rhythm influence how the brain processes reality? That same line of inquiry later shows up in civilian patents involving flashing lights, timed pulses, and sound frequencies. U.S. Patent 5356368 describes methods for inducing altered states of consciousness. Patent 6017302 discusses subliminal behavioral influence through audio and visual signals. Now, a patent doesn't prove something was deployed, but it does prove scientists were exploring the possibility, and that matters. Even inside MKUltra, researchers were asking whether sound and external sensory input could disrupt cognitive function without leaving visible injury. But it does show something else. Researchers were actively studying how to break memory, destabilize identity, and push the mind into states where perception and control start slipping apart. And once you accept that, well, then a new problem appears. Because when a mind fractures under extreme conditions, something has to organize the pieces. Someone or something decides which part remembers, which part obeys, which part stays buried. Survivors often describe internal roles with assigned functions and sometimes even assigned names. Now, maybe that reflects deliberate programming, or maybe it's the mind doing whatever it has to do to survive overwhelming trauma. Either way, the end result looks disturbingly similar. A person split into parts. And once you see that pattern, the next question gets harder to ignore. Because if identity can fracture under extreme conditions, who decides what those pieces become? She said the man wasn't wearing a lab coat. That detail stuck with me. Because when most people picture mind control experiments, they picture some doctor in a white coat standing in a sterile lab. But that's not how she described it. She said he wore a uniform and not like a doctor, more like a trainer. And when she asked where she was, he didn't answer the question. He just repeated a phrase, "Find the red room, do your job." She said her body moved, but her conscious mind didn't. But survivor testimony keeps describing something similar. Not some machine, people. Individuals who delivered instructions, reinforced conditioning, and seemed to activate dissociated states. What some survivors refer to as handlers. Now, I'll be honest, that word makes people uneasy, and I get why. But when I started digging into the psychology behind it, something caught my attention. The idea of structured internal roles responding to outside cues, that part isn't science fiction. In 1992, psychiatrist Dr. D. Corden Hammond gave a lecture to a room full of mental health professionals. It later became known as the Greenbaum speech. Hammond didn't claim the CIA confirmed a program called Monarch. What he described were patterns clinicians kept seeing across different patients. Trauma-induced dissociation. Patients describing separate internal roles inside the same mind. And when I first read that, I remember thinking, well, that's oddly specific. The kind of thing that makes you stop and look twice. Around the same time, another name kept appearing in the background of this history. Dr. Louise Jolion West. West was the head of psychiatry at UCLA. He was also a documented MKUltra contractor. In correspondence with the CIA, West proposed creating a controlled environment where researchers could study violence, dissociation, and behavioral modification. But one part of that proposal stood out to me. He emphasized experiments where the subjects would not know they were being manipulated. Now, those proposals were never publicly approved, at least not in any surviving document. But what matters more is the idea itself, because later military and psychological warfare research keeps circling back to the same basic premise. If you can shape perception, you don't always need force. Which brings us to something else that caught my attention. After Vietnam, the US Army started funding research into psychological warfare that didn't rely on physical force. One strange product of that effort was something called the First Earth Battalion Manual. Sounds weird, but it was written by Lieutenant Colonel Jim Channon, and the manual openly discussed ideas like influencing behavior through tone, repetition, and psychological suggestion. The point wasn't to control people with weapons. It was to shape how they perceived reality long before a single bullet or bomb ever showed up. Another document from that era pushed the idea even further. In 1980, Psychological Operations Officer Michael Aquino published a paper called From PSYOP to Mind War. His argument was that modern warfare wouldn't start with tanks or missiles. It would start by shaping belief first, by influencing how populations think long before the first shot is ever fired. Now, to be clear, Aquino was never convicted of anything related to monarch claims. He denied those accusations until his death, and that matters. But the broader idea he described, shaping belief as a form of warfare, well, that never disappeared. It became part of modern influence doctrine. Which brings us back to the survivor accounts. Because when people describe these alleged handlers, they rarely talk about restraints or locked rooms. They talk about triggers. Simple phrases, certain tones of voice.
Raymond Prentice Shaw.
Yes.
Even songs that could play anywhere without anyone noticing. One survivor said a specific song could cause her to lose hours of time. Another described nursery rhymes repeated during childhood conditioning. Now, maybe that's just PTSD. Trauma is well known to anchor powerful emotional responses to sound and language. That explanation absolutely has to stay on the table. But here's what keeps bothering clinicians. It's not just fear responses survivors describe. It's the way some of them describe structure. People talk about certain cues activating specific roles inside their mind, behaviors that appear without conscious recall. If those memories are inaccurate, they still show how deeply trauma can reorganize identity. But if they're accurate, then something else becomes possible. A form of control that doesn't need chains or locked doors. Just memory. In the right words, spoken at the right moment. Because if control really worked that way, it wouldn't have to look dramatic. It would just have to work. And once you start looking for triggers, you start noticing them everywhere. A woman walks onto a stage in front of millions of people. She's smiling, lights everywhere, cameras everywhere. And for a second, something about the visuals feels strange. There are butterflies on the costume, a mirror shattering across the screen behind her, and black and white patterns moving under her feet. The crowd cheers, because to them, this isn't a warning, it's just a performance. Now, when people start talking about Monarch, this is usually the moment where things begin drifting off course a little. Not because those symbols exist, but because once you notice them, it becomes really easy to start assigning meaning to everything. According to some survivor testimony, certain images were paired with traumatic moments during dissociative episodes. Things like butterflies, mirrors, dolls, or checkerboard patterns. Not symbols in the poetic sense, more like anchors. And the psychology behind that part is actually well understood. When someone experiences overwhelming trauma, the brain often binds that emotional state to whatever sensory details happen to be present in that moment. A particular sound in that room, a smell in the air, or even a specific visual image can get tied to the experience. Years later, when that same cue shows up again, the emotional state can come back with it. But here's the part people skip over. Triggers are personal, tied to individual experience, and most of the time, they mean absolutely nothing to anyone else. And that matters, because the next step people usually take is where the theory starts writing itself. They start noticing the same kinds of images showing up in pop culture. Butterflies, broken mirrors, even storylines built around split identities or dual personalities. And suddenly, the assumption becomes that something intentional must be happening. But slow down for a second. There are far more ordinary explanations. Artists reuse visual language all the time. Marketing leans hard on emotionally charged imagery. And themes like identity, transformation, and memory show up in storytelling because people instinctively respond to them. Still, something about the pattern made me curious. So I started looking at one of the biggest storytelling machines in the world, Disney, as in Walt Disney. In 1954, the Walt Disney Company signed a documented cooperation agreement with the U.S. Department of Defense. That's public record. Now, that doesn't mean Disney ran mind control programs, but what it does show is something much simpler. The government understands the power of narrative. Stories shape perception, and Disney has spent nearly a century telling stories. So when you look at those stories, certain themes appear again and again. Memory loss, for example. In Finding Nemo, Dory struggles with fragmented memory. In Frozen, Elsa grows up suppressing a part of herself she doesn't fully understand. Then there's the theme of children separated from family. Bambi loses his mother. Dumbo is taken away from his. Lilo grows up without parents and clings to the idea of family as something fragile.
Ohana means family. Family means nobody gets left behind.
Now, those themes could come from mythology. They could come from psychology. Or they could simply reflect the kinds of stories audiences connect with. But the overlap with trauma narratives is quite interesting. And then there's pop music. Let's take Beyoncé, for example. During the Sasha Fierce era, she openly described that persona as something she created for the stage. In her 2008 Oprah interview, she said, I quote, "I have someone else that takes over when it's time for me to work," and described Sasha as the part of her that comes out when she performs.
The moment right before when you're nervous and that other thing kind of takes over for you.
Uh-huh.
Then Sasha Fierce appears and my posture and the way I speak and everything is different.
Lady Gaga did something similar with Joe Calderon, a full male alter ego she brought into the You and I era, then performed as publicly at the 2011 MTV Video Music Awards. Years later, she said that persona helped her process how she was seeing men and identity at the time. Katy Perry has leaned hard into metamorphosis imagery for years, and not subtly either. In 2024, she promoted her album 143 wearing a butterfly-shaped breastplate. And in 2025, one of the signature visuals on her Lifetime's tour literally had her riding a giant butterfly prop above the crowd during Roar. Britney Spears is the hardest one to talk about carefully, because this is where people start projecting fast. She didn't publicly brand an alter ego the way Beyoncé or Gaga did. But during the height of her fame, the public record is full of a young star under relentless pressure, visibly fragmented by the machine around her. That's not a monarch claim. That's just what the footage looks like. And when people later attach programming language to Britney, what they're usually responding to is not a document. It's the visual of a person who looks like she's being split in real time. Pop culture keeps returning to the same imagery, masks, mirrors, metamorphosis, alter selves, reinvention, because audiences are deeply wired to respond to it. Now, listen carefully here. None of that proves programming or coordination, but here's what is documented. There's a CIA document from 1955 titled Hypnotic Experimentation and Research that discusses hypnosis, repetition, and the use of sensory cues to reinforce altered states. That part is not interpretation, it's in the record. So when survivors say certain images still trigger emotional reactions decades later, that actually lines up with what trauma science already understands. What it does not establish is intent, coordination, or modern deployment. And this is where restraint matters. Because once you start forcing meaning onto every symbol you see, you stop investigating. You start projecting. The symbols themselves don't prove monarch. What they show is something narrower, and honestly, much more believable. It's that trauma leaves fingerprints in memory, and culture has a habit of recycling the same images over and over again, sometimes without realizing where those images originally came from. Which raises a different question entirely. Not whether pop culture is programming people, but what happens when unresolved trauma slowly turns into aesthetics? When memory becomes style, and the same images that once meant survival end up printed on stage costumes and album covers. Because if trauma can anchor meaning to symbols, then the real mystery isn't the images themselves, it's what those images might still be waking up in people who remember where they came from. You don't need some secret basement lab to study how the brain responds to stimulus. You just need rhythm. One survivor once said something that stuck with me. She told the therapist she didn't really remember the pain, but she remembered the sound, just a tone that was barely noticeable, and then nothing. She said it felt like the moment simply disappeared. Now, for a long time, when people talked about mind control, they imagined something mechanical. Wires on someone's head, electrodes, drugs, needles, the whole laboratory picture. But neuroscience eventually started looking at something much simpler, entrainment. The idea that the brain naturally syncs itself to repeating sensory patterns, things like pulsing light, steady sound rhythms, or even a simple timed beat. Your brain actually does this all the time. Musicians notice it when an entire crowd starts clapping in the same rhythm. Sleep researchers use it when certain tones help guide the brain into deeper sleep cycles. Meditation programs use rhythm and tone patterns to calm the nervous system. So that part isn't fringe science. It's studied openly. Now, when I first started reading about this, I had to slow myself down a little. Because once you start going down this rabbit hole, it's easier to jump straight into conspiracy territory. But precision matters here. What we're talking about is influence, not control, and those are two very different things. For example, in 1998, a US patent was filed, patent number 601-7302. It describes a method for using acoustic signals below the level of conscious hearing to influence mood, attention, or emotional state. Not obedience, not commands, just subtle influence. Earlier work explored similar questions. One concept called silent sound spread spectrum looked at whether information could be carried through frequencies people wouldn't consciously hear. Originally, this was explored for military communication systems. Now, before anyone runs too far with that idea, we should be clear about something. A patent doesn't prove anyone used these methods on unwilling subjects. But what it does prove is interest. Scientists and engineers we're asking how sound interacts with the brain below conscious awareness. And those questions didn't start in the 1990s. They show up much earlier, during MKUltra, one of the projects, Subproject 119. And it looked at how brainwave activity responds to external stimulus, including things like strobe lighting, pulsed signals, and different sound frequencies. The goal wasn't obedience. It was to make a person easier to disorient, easier to influence, and easier to get access to psychologically. And when MKUltra officially ended in the early 1970s, those scientific questions didn't disappear, they just moved. Some research shifted into universities, some into private contractors, and some into defense research labs, places like DARPA, Bell Labs, organizations studying neural interfaces, perception, and how humans interact with machines. Now, that doesn't mean anyone continued monarch, but it does show something important. The curiosity never stopped. And that brings us back to triggers. Trauma science already shows that memory can anchor itself to sensory details. A specific song, a certain lighting pattern, even the hum of a particular kind of electrical equipment. Veterans with PTSD experience this all the time. A sound can bring the past rushing back instantly. So when survivors say certain sounds or lighting patterns cause dissociation, that alone doesn't prove programming. It could simply be trauma memory doing what trauma memory does. But clinicians sometimes notice something else in these reports. Not just fear, structure. People describing behavioral shifts almost like stepping into a different internal role. Now, I want to be careful here. That doesn't prove external control. But it does raise a question, because the science already knows something uncomfortable. Human perception can be nudged. Attention can be biased. Mood can be influenced. All without anyone even touching you. Which means the real takeaway here isn't that the brain can be controlled like a puppet. No, it can't. But it can be steered. A little. And when trauma enters the equation, steering becomes much easier. And again, that doesn't prove monarch, but it does explain why the idea refuses to disappear. Because once you understand how sensitive the brain is to rhythm, sound, and the environment, the line between psychology and conditioning starts looking a lot thinner than most people realize. She didn't want to tell her story. For years, she said she believed there would be consequences if she did. But in the mid-1990s, Kathy O'Brien went public anyway. And when she did, other people started speaking too. Now, this is where the monarch conversation shifts a little. Up to this point, we've been looking at documents, research programs, and psychological theory. But here, the story moves somewhere else, into testimony. Now, we need to slow down here and be very clear about something. There is no independent corroboration for those accusations, no confirming documents, and no criminal convictions tied to those claims. No government agency has ever acknowledged a program called Monarch. That distinction matters, because allegations and evidence are not the same thing. O'Brien claimed that beginning in early childhood, she experienced repeated trauma severe enough to cause dissociation. According to her account, that dissociation didn't simply happen as a side effect of abuse. She believed it was reinforced and eventually used deliberately. She said certain phrases, songs, and environmental cues could activate different internal states, and she believed those states were assigned specific functions. The framework she believed all of this happened under had a name, Project Monarch. O'Brien also named individuals she believed were involved, including people she said were connected to politics and entertainment. O'Brien's description of what she says happened to her is extremely disturbing. She claimed the abuse she experienced began when she was very young and involved repeated trauma severe enough to overwhelm the mind. According to her account, the trauma wasn't random. She believed it was intentional, meant to fracture identity through dissociation. Once that fracture existed, she said different parts of her personality were trained separately. Some identities, she claimed, were conditioned for obedience, others for exploitation, and others for carrying messages or information without the conscious mind remembering. She also alleged that material was recorded and later used as leverage to control victims. O'Brien further claimed she was transferred between handlers she believed had connections to powerful political figures, including two U.S. presidents whom she named publicly. Those allegations have never been independently verified. No documents have confirmed them, but that is what she said happened. O'Brien wasn't the only person describing something like this either. Another woman named Bryce Taylor came forward years later. She had a different childhood, different locations, and a completely different life story. But the internal structure she described sounded oddly familiar. She said different internal identities were assigned different roles, and that certain phrases, symbols, or environmental cues could activate those identities. These claims have never been independently confirmed, but when two people with no obvious connection start describing similar internal structures, well, clinicians tend to pay attention. Taylor's account includes additional allegations of violence used to enforce obedience. She claimed a handler once injured her deliberately as a warning. She also alleged that her daughter was later subjected to similar conditioning. According to Taylor, the process involved electroshock, severe trauma in environments she believed were connected to military or intelligence facilities. But those two accounts weren't even the earliest ones. Decades before either woman spoke publicly, a different story surfaced. A model from the 1940s named Candy Jones. Jones was a public figure in her time, appearing on magazine covers and television. Then, in the 1970s, something unusual happened. During hypnosis sessions recorded by her husband, radio host Long John Nebel, Jones said she believed she had been used by the CIA as a courier. She described a secondary personality she called Arlene. Now, according to Jones, Arlene could be activated through specific phone calls and verbal commands. She claimed that when Arlene was present, she carried out assignments she could not consciously remember afterward. Now, that doesn't prove those memories were accurate. Recovered memory, especially under hypnosis, is extremely controversial. But it does establish something important. Stories about dissociative couriers existed decades before the phrase Project Monarch entered public conversation. Then another name appeared in the record, Paul Bonacci. Bonacci testified under oath in federal court during proceedings connected to the Franklin child exploitation scandal. He described severe childhood abuse, dissociation, and large gaps in memory. In 1999, a U.S. district court awarded Bonacci damages for psychological harm resulting from abuse. But the court did not confirm mind control. It did not validate Monarch. What the court recognized was trauma consistent with dissociative disorder. That distinction matters. In later interviews, Bonacci expanded on what he said he experienced during childhood. He described ritualized abuse and participation in recorded activities connected to exploitation networks. He also claimed that dissociation training involved strobe lighting, chanting, and repeated trauma. According to Bonacci, many of these memories surfaced gradually during therapy. He said therapist notes and affidavits documented parts of those sessions. Another name appears across several of these accounts, Michael Aquino. Multiple witnesses alleged Aquino was involved in abusive networks connected to psychological conditioning. Aquino denied those accusations completely. He was never convicted of any crime related to Monarch allegations. In 1986, during the Presidio daycare investigation, Aquino and his wife were questioned by authorities. The case was later closed for lack of evidence. That's the legal record. So what are we left with? A recurring pattern that keeps showing up. Across multiple decades, different individuals with no clear connection to one another describe severe trauma leading to dissociation, internal identities assigned different roles, triggers tied to words, sounds, or symbols, and long gaps in conscious memory. Now, there are several explanations that could account for that. False memory, therapeutic suggestion, or simple cultural contamination where stories begin influencing each other over time. All of those possibilities have to stay on the table. But the remaining question isn't really emotional. It's structural. What clinical, cultural, or institutional process could produce this level of similarity across decades and geography without coordination? Because whatever the answer is, we clearly don't understand it yet. And that is exactly why these stories refuse to disappear. Now, picture a kid sitting on the floor watching a sci-fi cartoon. There's a pop star in the show who has two personalities. One version of her follows orders. The other one doesn't even know the first one exists. To a kid watching at home, it's just a storyline, just entertainment. But years later, that same girl says something strange started happening. Every time the theme song from that show played, she would dissociate. Now, when I first heard that story, I remember thinking, okay, well, that's odd, but it doesn't prove anything. Memory is weird like that. Music sticks to moments in our lives all the time. Still, it got me thinking about something. Because if you step back for a minute, the place where stories live today looks very different than it did during the Cold War. Back then, programs like MKUltra needed secrecy, hidden facilities, controlled environments. That was the laboratory. But the world we live in now works quite differently. Stories don't stay in controlled rooms anymore. They move through screens, through phones, streaming platforms, And once that thought crossed my mind, I had to stop and ask myself something. Has media ever been used to intentionally influence how people think? Well, turns out, yes, it has. Back in the early Cold War, the CIA became involved in documented efforts to shape media coverage and public perception through relationships with journalists and publishers. That part is very real. Now, the specific labels people attach to those efforts get messy. But the underlying idea? That didn't disappear. It just evolved. Because by the end of the 20th century, influencing perception didn't require planting articles in newspapers anymore. It required scale, and nothing scales like entertainment. The Department of Defense eventually created something called the Entertainment Liaison Office. Its job is actually pretty straightforward. If a film studio wants access to military bases, aircraft, tanks, technical advisors, well, they can request it. But there's a trade-off. Scripts are reviewed, sometimes adjusted. Now, that arrangement isn't hidden, it's openly acknowledged. And when journalists at The Intercept obtained the Department of Defense Film Liaison Database in 2020, they found a massive record of military involvement across thousands of entertainment projects over the years. Thousands. When I saw that, I actually had to stop for a second. Because thousands. That includes movies and shows tied to military themes, government cooperation, and national security storytelling. Now, here's where it gets very interesting. These aren't always just stories about war. A lot of modern entertainment, especially in the broader culture around those projects, keep circling the same ideas. Memory loss, secret experiments, government programs, characters split between two identities. And before anyone jumps to conclusions, that does not mean those movies are mind control tools. But it does reveal something important. People who study behavior understand that storytelling shapes perception. That's not conspiracy, that's just psychology. Now, to be fair, not every military-reviewed script is some grand psychological operation. That'd be ridiculous. But institutions that study behavior have been asking similar questions for decades. Take, for example, the Tavistock Institute in the United Kingdom. During World War II, it focused on psychological resilience in soldiers. After the war, researchers there began studying how media, music, and symbols influence group behavior. Then there's the RAND Corporation. RAND has spent decades producing research tied to US defense planning. If you dig through their work from the late 20th century, you start seeing papers about things like cognitive priming, perception shaping, and narrative influence. One RAND paper from 2001 asked the question that made me stop cold for a second. Could entertainment reshape national identity if it repeatedly paired stories with emotional experiences? Now, that's not conspiracy blog asking that. That's publicly funded behavioral science. And today, the reach of those narratives is massive. Movies, streaming shows, short videos, TikToks. The same themes pop up everywhere. Memory loss, hidden identities, voices guiding characters from inside their own minds. Now, maybe those are just storytelling tropes. Probably are. But once you've spent time reading trauma research, you start noticing the overlap. And then something else enters the picture. The algorithms. Because modern platforms don't just deliver stories anymore. They optimize them. In the last few years, internal documents and reporting from major social media companies have shown just how aggressively platforms test and refine what holds attention, what drives emotion, and what keeps people engaged. When I first started reading through some of that, I had to laugh a little, because everybody keeps calling it optimization. But from a human perspective, it's the industrial study of reaction. These systems adjust what you see based on your behavior. How long you pause, what you replay, what makes you stop scrolling. In other words, the system doesn't understand trauma, but it's extremely good at detecting emotional reaction. It learns what holds attention, what creates fear, what makes people stay. And if trauma really does leave sensory fingerprints in memory, you have to ask a strange question. What happens when an algorithm accidentally finds them? One survivor described eventually stopping movies altogether. Not because she didn't enjoy them, but because certain scenes triggered flashbacks. A camera angle, a shift in lighting, a line of dialogue that lands in exactly the wrong place. When that happens, she says it feels like someone else takes over for a moment. Now, she doesn't believe filmmakers are doing that intentionally, but the experience still feels real to her, and that's the uncomfortable part. Because if something like Monarch-style conditioning ever existed, continuing it today wouldn't require secret laboratories. It would require repetition. And repetition today doesn't live in black sites. It lives somewhere much more ordinary, right in your pocket, on your phone. So at this point, we need to do the only honest thing left. Stop chasing the feeling of the story for a second, and let's test it. Because this is where a lot of channels lose me. They line up enough weird details to make something feel true, and then they stop asking if it actually is. And I don't want to do that here. So I asked the simplest question I could. If Project Monarch were real, what should actually be there? Not what makes a great podcast or what makes a good video. Not what sounds insane at 1 a.m. with headphones on. I mean the boring stuff. And right away, there's a problem. There is no declassified document anywhere that confirms a CIA program called Project Monarch. None. And trust me, if that document existed, this episode would be a whole lot easier. But it doesn't exist, and that matters. And if Monarch really was some centralized operation, you'd expect a cleaner footprint than this. You'd expect people using the same language, the same terms, the same names crossing over in records you can actually verify. Some kind of connective tissue. Something that lets you say, okay, this piece really does lead to that piece. But that's not really what you get. What you mostly get are testimonies that sometimes line up in structure, but not in documentation. And that distinction matters more than people think. Because a pattern in testimony can mean something. It can. But it is not the same thing as a proven system. Now, this is where people get lazy. They hear there's no document, and they go one of two directions. Either, oh, well, then this is all fake, or, well, that proves they hid it. And no, neither one is good enough. The truth might be uglier than both of those. It might be that people are collapsing different things into one story. Real government research into coercion and behavior. Real survivors dealing with severe trauma and dissociation. And then a larger framework called Monarch that became the name used to explain all of it. That possibility stuck with me because it explains why parts of the story feel solid, while other parts fall apart the second you push on them. And honestly, that may be the hardest version of this whole thing. Not that there was some neat little black budget program with a label on the folder, but that real abuse, real psychological research, and real fragmentation of memory got fused together into something bigger than any one institution. Which means some people may be describing something very real while naming it wrong. That is not a small distinction. Now, we also have to be honest about memory, especially recovered memory. In the 1980s and 1990s, some therapists used hypnosis and regression techniques way too loosely. That happened. Some memories were almost certainly shaped by suggestion. That's real too. And if we ignore that because it's inconvenient, then we're doing exactly what we claim we hate. But here's the part people miss. Even if someone is wrong about the framework, that does not automatically mean they're wrong about the trauma. Those are not the same claim. A person can be wrong about the architecture and still be telling the truth about the damage. That might be the single most important line in this entire episode. Because once you understand that, the question changes. It stops being, was there a proven program called Project Monarch? And instead becomes, did real systems of abuse, coercion, conditioning, and dissociation exist that later got grouped under that name? That question is a lot harder to laugh off, and a lot harder to dismiss, honestly. So here's where I land. I cannot tell you Project Monarch has been proven, because it hasn't. I cannot tell you there is hard evidence of a documented intelligence program by that exact name, because there isn't. and I'm not going to fake certainty just because the story is compelling. But I also can't look at the documented history of MKUltra, the reality of dissociation, the long record of coercive behavior research, and the recurring structure inside multiple testimonies and pretend all of that means nothing. That would be dishonest too. So the most truthful answer I can give you is this. The name is unproven. The pattern is harder to dismiss. And once you separate those two, the story actually gets worse. Because then you're not asking whether one secret program existed. You're asking how many real things got buried because everybody was arguing over the wrong name. The part of this story that stayed with me wasn't the code names, it wasn't the symbols, wasn't even the question of whether Monarch was real in the way people say it was. It was something completely different and much smaller than that. And honestly worse, it was the idea of a child learning to disappear inside their own mind. Because disappearing was the safest option they had. That one's hard to shake and hard to swallow. Because once you sit with that for a minute, really sit with it, a lot of the argument starts to feel smaller. Was it Monarch? Was it something else? Was it memory contamination? Was it a name people gave to something they couldn't explain? Those questions matter, of course, they do, but not as much as the damage. And that's the part I keep coming back to. Because if you've ever watched your kids sleeping on the couch, or heard them laughing in the next room, or just had one of those random little moments where you realize how much of their mind is still soft, still forming, the idea of someone breaking that on purpose? Man, I don't know what to do with that except tell the truth as carefully as I can. And maybe that's where this episode really lands for me. Not in proving every claim, not in pretending every story is airtight, but in refusing to laugh at pain just because the explanation sounds strange. Because sometimes the label is wrong. Sometimes the memory is incomplete. Sometimes the story gets tangled, but the wound is still there. And if there's one thing this investigation kept forcing me to come back to, it's this. A human mind can survive things we almost don't want to believe. That doesn't make every claim true, but it should make us a hell of a lot slower to dismiss what trauma actually does. So maybe the final question here isn't whether Monarch was real. Maybe the final question is simpler than that. How many people spent their whole lives trying to describe something very real using the only language they had and got treated like the problem instead? Thanks for being here tonight. If you want more stories like this, you know where to find me, you know where the links are. And if you choose to support the channel, it really helps. I'll see you next time.